Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 72, Mud and Molasses. Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah, podcasting from Yin Hu Cha Yuan, Silver Lake Tea House. Show notes for this episode can be found on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode features the following segments: The Back Porch, The Front Porch, Sheep to Shawl, Off the Shelf, Ever Expanding Skill Set, and Double Happiness. I'd like to welcome Cindy Sordenitz, who is Cindy from California and introduced herself on the introductions thread on Ravelry. I'd also like to say a special hello to Pause for Stitches. I hope your spinning is going much better. And I'd like to say a very, very special thank you to listener Katrina, who sent a beautiful card, a lovely note, and a donation to the Yarns at Yin Hu podcast for mailing expenses. And that is very welcome. Totally unnecessary, but very welcome. So thank you, Katrina. It's St. Patrick's Day. I have a festive beverage. And it's so nice to be podcasting at about 7:30 here at Yin Hu Cha Yuan. There is still some light in the sky, and there's a fantastic breeze that's happening. It's banging some things against the house, and even though it's rather mild this week, it feels quite chilly with all of that wind going on outside. The ice in the creek has thawed, and over the weekend, we saw two male mergansers and a female swimming around, paddling along the creek. Usually there is a lot of duck activity here in the spring. And the snow is not completely gone, but it's mostly melted in the spots around the house. It's nice to see the ground again and to start smelling that first time you go outside in the spring and you smell the earth smell. That's a really nice feeling. So I think that's right around the corner. There have been little whiffs here or there, but I think maybe this weekend or next week we'll be able to get that full experience. Things are greening up around here, and to help that along, I have put up some photos of contest yarn that you could win by posting something green to the contest thread on Ravelry. These beautiful skeins of green yarn were generously donated by Deb Little Red Hen, and they are up for grabs if you post something green. I was thinking that I would close the contest and determine the winners when the Ravelry group reaches 400 members. We are nearly there. So listeners, if you've been listening and you haven't joined the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry, please do so. And while you're there, take some time to introduce yourself if you'd like. I'll give you a hello on the next episode and to post something green for your chance to win some of this really special yarn. the back porch. This weekend, I completed Ashburn, a shawl pattern by Melanie Berg. The pattern calls for yarn in three different colors, and there is a slipped stitch detail creating stripes of the center color through the first section and the third section. Predominantly, it's a garter stitch shawl. There is a textured section in the center, and I followed the directions loosely with this pattern. The yarn that I used was a bit different from the yarn called for, and that caused me to make some decisions about altering the pattern. I put some notes about this on my project page. I used Soulful Stash. I think I mentioned in a previous episode that I am participating in the Soulful Stash Swap, sponsored by Sarah of FiberTrek and Claire of New Hampshire Knits. I have a swap partner, and before I found out that Gretchen was my swap partner, I started looking through my stash with a lens for what is soulful. For me, all of my handspun is soulful yarn, but I was thinking about, okay, what purchases have I made? On the way back from Vermont, my mom and I stopped at the Green Mountain Spinnery this summer, and I made some gift purchases and then some things that I ended up keeping in my stash. So I used two different yarns. They're both single spun yarns. One was a wool Tencel blend and one was a wool mohair blend. And the third yarn that I used was a Jacob yarn, a 2-ply fingering weight yarn from Ross Farm. So I had a blue, a very sunny yellow, and a heathery gray. I'm calling this shawl Sun and Clouds because I think it's a beautiful combination of very atmospheric colors with that bright sunny yellow right in the center and stripes of that yellow in the blue and the gray sections. I really like that choice, although if I were to knit this design again, and it's a great design, so I can see myself knitting it again, I would choose three colors that had a little more diversity in color value. The blue and the gray are a little bit too similar, in my opinion. I like them together, but there's really not the diversity of color that you should have in a three-color project. Last night, I finished the weaving in of ends, and I gave the shawl a light steam blocking on the wrong side. It's mostly garter stitch, so it's nice and squishy, and I wore my Sun and Clouds shawl today. It was really nice on a cold and windy and damp day, and I love the pattern. That's Ashburn, a design by Melanie Berg. The front porch. I need to choose my upcoming knitting project very carefully because I have an overnight field trip planned and I'm going to have a lot of on-the-bus time and a lot of sitting in classrooms and auditorium seating, watching students debate kind of time. It's kind of ideal knitting time, but it requires just the right project. Nothing too fiddly, nothing with a lot of pattern directions, and something with enough color and interest that I can really sustain my energy while knitting and not sort of lull myself into a sleepy state. You don't get a lot of sleep on overnight field trips, so it's easy to become sleepy. I've done some thinking about this afternoon, and so far I've determined that the pattern to knit is actually a re-knit. I think I'm going to work on a second flickerl. It's flicker with an L. And this is a pattern by Simone Eich of Woolwork Designs. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you've heard me admire Simone and Woolwork Designs before. Simone has some really fantastic asymmetrical patterns. This pattern, Flickerl, happens to be a free pattern and is ideal for scraps. I was reading the directions and she actually calls for sock yarn scraps. But I was looking at my sock yarn scraps and many of them are multicolored. I think this pattern works really well with a little bit less variation in each yarn so that you can create a striping effect. It's a linen stitch, so the shawl looks like it's woven. It's a little bit slow going because your knitting doesn't build as quickly as it does with, say, stockinette or garter stitch, but the result is visually stunning. It's interesting to choose what color comes after each color, and there's no weaving in ends. Because you use the ends to create a nice fringe along one side of the shawl. So I wouldn't need a lot of notions. I wouldn't need stitch markers or anything fidgety like that to work on this shawl pattern. I say shawl, but it's more like a scarf because it's a rather shallow shawl. And I think it could be fun. That's my plan right now. I have until tomorrow evening while I'm packing to change my mind. I'll also be bringing along my drop spindles because I might find a few moments to work on that. And I also have a pair of socks that I've been working on forever that I will bring along as well. I think it's time to turn the heel on those socks. And I'm not a very experienced sock knitter, so it would not be a good idea for me to turn the heel on this trip. But I'll have to look at how much yarn I have left, and maybe I can just work on the cuffs a little bit more before I turn the heel. This past Saturday was session 3 of the Sheep to Shawl class that I'm taking at the Fibercraft Studio in Chestnut Ridge, New York. I can't believe it's the third session already. We focused this session on plying techniques, and there was also a bit of biographical work. There's kind of a guest presenter who is working us through some activities having to do with the four elements. So in session 2, we talked about earth, and in session 3, we talked about water, and we engaged in a number of things: storytelling, movement, working with art materials, and things like that. And although no one has stated that the purpose of thinking about these elements is to expand our investigation a little bit in such a way that it might work its way into design or patterning of the shawl or garment that we will eventually knit. No one has stated that outright, but it seems to me that that is part of the objective, at least, of this biographical work, where we mine our thinking about the elements and we engage in these activities as a way to deepen our experience. It certainly deepens our relationship to one another. One of the things that we did this past week was we created a communal pastel representation of water, where everyone started with a little section of paper in front of them. And then we moved slowly at first, but gradually more quickly as we worked our way all the way around the table. And we were touching and manipulating and adding color and adding gesture to the works of others as we went. I included a photograph of our work on the show notes of the podcast. After lunch, there's quite a long spell of time that is devoted to handwork. And as I mentioned, this week we were working on plying techniques. So we've been working with spindles. Folks have some different kinds of spindles. Most people are using the spindles that we made in the first session of the class. And then we worked on making a plying ball. I had never made a plying ball by wrapping the yarn around my thumb. So that was a new technique and one that I was really glad to learn. I'm used to having a plying ball because I removed all the parts of my Turkish spindle. But learning how to wrap one around your thumb, that was really cool. And then this week, more than in the past, maybe because we know each other a little bit better, but I think also because the nature of these plying balls and trying to manipulate the plying ball and the spindle, and there's tangling, and sometimes the yarn is overspun so it wants to kink up on itself. There was a lot of interaction and helping one another with these techniques. And there was just this quiet hum of conversation around the room and work going on. It was just really lovely. We haven't had a Saturday yet without precipitation. The first two sessions featured snow falling while we were working. And this past Saturday, it was raining quite steadily for most of the day. So it was kind of cold and damp outside and warm and lovely inside. The main workspace of the Fibercraft studio is just an incredibly uplifting, it's almost a spiritual space. Really nice place to work, plenty of room for a lot of participants, lots of tools and things to use and share, just this wonderful openness, and it's infused with such incredible meaning. So again, it was a lovely day. We were given some homework, which included starting to knit with our hand-spun yarn, perhaps knitting a swatch. And our first assignment is to create a small bag or pouch with some of our hand-spun yarn. I have an idea for what I'd like to do, and I've worked out a draft for that idea. And hopefully I'll be able to talk a little bit more about it on the next episode or two, because I've made some progress. I think I'm at the point in my Fibercraft where my ideas for what is possible exceed my actual ability to execute them. So that's a hurdle that I'm going to need to work through, and I think this Sheep to Shawl class is a perfect way to work through some of those things, and there's certainly an abundance of expertise in the room. Lots of ideas, lots of great conversation. We were also left with a reading, and the woman who has been doing our biography work with us emailed a poem. It's called Lingering in Happiness, and it's by Mary Oliver, who is a poet I love, but I have not read this poem before receiving it. And I'd like to read it to you. Lingering in Happiness. After rain, after many days without rain, it stays cool, private, and cleansed under the trees, and the dampness there, married now to gravity, falls branch to branch, leaf to leaf, down to the ground where it will disappear. But not, of course, vanish, except to our eyes. The roots of the oaks will have their share, and the white threads of the grasses and the cushion of moss. A few drops, round as pearls, will enter the mole's tunnel, and soon so many small stones, buried for 1,000 years, will feel themselves being touched. Off the Shelf. We have reached the formal conclusion of the first Yarns at Yin Hu read along. Our text was Housekeeping by Marilyn Robinson, and it has been an absolute pleasure reading along with Yarns at Yin Hu listeners. I hope that you have enjoyed reading the book. Maybe you're still reading it. Are you still reading? I won't be giving any spoilers, really. This isn't a plot-driven text, so I think knowing aspects of the plot don't necessarily ruin the reading. But I would like to put a bit of closure, I suppose, on our book discussion and encourage you, if you haven't already, to check into the lively discussion that's going on the Ravelry board. It's been just so encouraging enough for me to think about maybe doing this again in the future. And if you've enjoyed yourself, or even if you missed out entirely, but you'd like to take part in a read-along in the future, I would like to know. I would like to know if you have any suggestions of works. I'm very interested in this kind of literary fiction or maybe memoir, something that offers, I guess it offers a lot of potential for readers to have different opinions or bring their different perspectives and backgrounds to the work. I've been thinking a lot about the water element to this text, especially since encountering water as a topic in the Sheep to Shawl session this past weekend. And that was such a moving aspect of the work, to read all of the different ways that water enters the characters' lives. The lake, the flooding of the house, Ruth and Sylvie going out in a boat. There was also this moment I asked participants on the Ravelry thread if they thought using the term baptism was going too far, and someone said, no, it's not going too far. But there seemed to be some consensus about the pivotal portion of the text where you start to feel like you're drawing toward the end of the work. And there was a lot of agreement about this feeling like that night when Ruth and Lucille spend the night alone out in the woods by the lake is a pivotal scene. And it occurred to me, not initially when I was writing about it and talking about it, but later, it occurred to me that on the way back in the morning, before it warms up, before it's light and bright at the water's edge, Ruth falls in to the lake, and Lucille does not. I'm pretty sure that's how it goes. And to me, thinking about it in retrospect, that was kind of baptismal symbolism, because Ruth ends up drawing closer to Sylvie while Lucille moves away. And there are lots of instances that mark Lucille's increasing distance from Sylvie and her ways. There are some more references to fiber and fabric. Someone mentioned spindling. There's a description of the doilies on the sofa that were once like plump and full, and now they're worn and almost greasy. And there's that great moment when Lucille stuffs her dress into the stove. I thought that was really wonderful. So I enjoyed, as I read through to the end, finding some more references to fiber and fabrics. And I would like to read a passage. I was thinking, well, what is the objective of reading this passage? What does it really show? I think maybe this is part of Marilynne Robinson's thesis in the work, kind of a major point that she would like to bring out. It echoes something in an earlier chapter. I probably won't be able to find it. There's a comment about, you know, that longing you feel is the thing that you're looking for or longing for. And this brings that idea, this passage brings that idea back with a little more expansion and discussion. I'm reading from chapter 8 in my text. This is on page 152. Imagine a Carthage sown with salt, and all the sowers gone, and the seeds lain however long in the earth, till there rose finally, in vegetable profusion, leaves and trees of rime and brine. What flowering would there be in such a garden? Light would force each salt calyx to open in prisms, and to fruit heavily with bright globes of water. Peaches and grapes are little more than that, and where the world was salt, there would be greater need of slaking. For need can blossom into all the compensations it requires. To crave and to have are as like as a thing and its shadow. For when does a berry break upon the tongue as sweetly as one longs to taste it? And when is the taste refracted into so many hues and savors of ripeness and earth? And when do our senses know anything so utterly as when we lack it? And here again is a foreshadowing. The world will be made whole. For to wish for a hand on one's hair is all but to feel it. So whatever we may lose, the very craving gives it back to us again. Though we dream and hardly know it, longing like an angel fosters us, smooths our hair, and brings us wild strawberries. Well, I don't know really what to say or how to reflect on that passage except to express how unbelievably powerful it is and how powerful it's been to read this work for a second time. I think that housekeeping is so rich and dense with meaning that it warrants a second, third, fourth, fifth reading. And maybe it would be something for me to revisit again in the future and read even more slowly. I agree with that reviewer, I forget who it was, who said, maybe it was Doris Lessing, said about the book, I found myself reading slowly and even more slowly. And that's certainly how I felt as I was reading, really savoring the work. One of the reasons I decided to host a read-along is that since my work with fiber and crafting has become such a big part of my life, my reading life has really fallen away. For many years, I taught literature, I taught advanced literature classes, and I would read 20, 30, 40 books a year. And that is not the case anymore, and I kind of fell away from my reading for a while. This read-along has revived my interest for sure in reading, although maybe reading of a different sort. And after completing housekeeping, I have begun reading some books that I initially gave as gifts, and now they've made their way back to me. The first time I attended Rhinebeck, New York Sheep and Wool, 2 years ago, I met Sylvia Joran. She's a farmer in upstate New York, and she's a writer. She's blogged about her experience, and then she had put out her first collection of these shorter pieces into a kind of memoir of her farming life. We met, I had my photograph taken with her, and she signed a book that I gave as a gift. And then last year, I saw her again and bought her second work, Improbable Shepherd, and I gave that as a gift as well. And I was secretly hoping that at some point those books would come back to me so I could read them and then return them to the recipient. And they have. So I've been reading Sylvia Joran. I really enjoy her writing a lot. She gives a great deal of attention to the landscape and to subtleties of atmosphere and environment, as well as sharing the trials and the very hard work of starting a farm rather late in life, I think. She definitely wasn't a young person, and so this was a lot of physical work to be undertaking as an adult in middle or maybe even later middle years. But she's so charming and kind of irreverent in the way she writes about it, and I've really been enjoying that. So I started to look online. I looked at her website and I found a few interviews that she gave several years ago. And one of the interviews included a recipe, her recipe for gingerbread. It's adapted from a James Beard recipe, and I thought, I need to try that. And wow, I really like this recipe for gingerbread. It's very simple. It calls for molasses, ginger, flour, a little bit of baking soda, boiling water, butter, and the ginger she calls for in her recipe is chopped up crystallized ginger. I adore ginger taste. And so, in addition to the crystallized ginger, I also grated fresh ginger into the recipe. And I made two recipes worth of this because I bought a jar of molasses and I just wanted to use up the whole thing because it was such a sticky mess that I really couldn't see putting it back in the cabinet and risk drawing ants and things like that. So I thought, I'm just going to make more of this bread. I made her recipe as specified, except for adding some fresh ginger. And I put that into two mini loaf pans. And then I made another recipe of it. And I added two eggs to that version. And I put it into an 8x8x2 baking dish. So the one with the eggs is a little bit cakier, and the one in the bread pans is a little bit more dense, like a bread. Both excellent, really good with a cup of tea, just perfect for this time of year where you don't really want anything sweet and light. You just want something robust and hearty and earthy and good. I have put a link to this recipe in the show notes, and I recommend that you give it a try. And it's also a segue for me to talk a little bit about tools for the hashtag Power Pantry that's been going on since January. I meant in the last episode to talk a little bit more about tools, but I ran out of time to talk about it, so I'd like to do that a little bit today. Hashtag Power Pantry is a year-long endeavor to really get the most out of my pantry, all the things in my kitchen, and to really think expansively about what pantry means in 2015. In January, we shared a lot about organization. In February, we played something called the pantry game, where we kind of issued trips to the grocery store and tried to cook with what was on hand. A lot of great ideas were shared. And in March, we're focusing on tools. I think that having certain tools around allows us to make the most of the ingredients we have on hand. And the conversation on the Ravelry thread has sort of entered a lot of different dimensions. Some folks are talking about, you know, their must-have tools, things that they love. Other folks are talking about tools and appliances and things they can do without. Someone said something about, you know, I really don't like having something in my kitchen that doesn't have a dual purpose. I'm done with the one type of use appliances. And I agree. I don't have room to store a lot of appliances, and there are a lot of things that I don't have. But I thought that this episode I would give some attention to 10 tools that are not essentials. I could certainly turn out meals and do all of the cooking I do without these tools. But every time I get one of these 10 things out, I think to myself, I'm so glad I have this. I'm so glad I know to use this. It really helps me maximize my time or my ingredients or something like that. I've put a list of these in the show notes, and I thought I'd share, maybe talk a little bit about them in this episode. Number one is a microplane. It's a small grater. I used it this past weekend to grate that ginger. It's really nice for ginger because the fibrous part of the ginger stays on top of the microplane and the good pulp comes out the bottom. It's easy to manipulate, easy to clean. If I don't need a box grater, I try not to get that out. And this often serves the purpose really well. I use it for ginger. I use it for cheese. I can use it for carrots. Anything, if I just need a small quantity, the microplane is really handy. I also love having a pair of kitchen snips. For years, I would use scissors and wash them and put them back with the writing implements. And I don't know, all of a sudden it dawned on me that I just need a dedicated pair of scissors for the kitchen. So I love having my kitchen snips. I love having metal tongs. I also love having silicone coated oven mitts. These are a relatively recent acquisition. I had some silicone mitts. They're very stiff and difficult to use. I like having them for my outdoor grill, but I rarely use them for indoor cooking. Recently, though, I had a gift certificate to, I don't know, one of these big box stores. And I was just looking in the sales section to see if there was anything interesting. And there was a really nice pair of oven mitts. They were quilted on the inside, but a very thin layer of silicone on the outside. They're flexible. I really like them. And I can touch something. I can rinse them off with the fabric oven mitts. Once you get them wet, then you can get a steam burn. And I can't deal with all of that. So these were a really smart purchase. Someone else on the board mentioned a slotted spoon. Oh, Heather 01851 mentioned a slotted spoon as a useful tool, and I love mine. What I often do if I'm making pasta or anything that calls for me to bring water or stock to a boil is that I will blanch my vegetables in that water and then retrieve them with a slotted spoon and put them on the side so that it's one less pot that I dirty. And then I have kind of an infused or enriched stock or broth with that additional vegetable flavor in there. And then I've cooked my vegetables and I have them, or partially cooked my vegetables and I have them sitting on the side to toss into my dish later. So I love the slotted spoon for that. I have an enamel-coated bowl with a tight-fitting plastic lid. It's quite a large bowl, and I really like this. It goes from mixing right into the refrigerator. I don't have to worry about finding plastic wrap or spooning something into another container to store it. This is a really useful tool. I also love having a ricer. Nothing beats it for excellent mashed potatoes, which I don't make very often. I'm not a huge mashed potato fan, even though most people love them. But when I make mashed potatoes, they are divine because I roast my potatoes in the oven. I bake them whole with just a couple fork pricks in them so they don't explode in the oven. So I bake them in the oven and then I quickly peel their outer skins off and I put them through a ricer instead of mashing them. And the chemistry of this is that the cell wall of the potato is only assaulted one time, whereas if you use a potato masher or a blender or something like that, you're actually activating like glutinous or gelatinous material in the potato, and that's what can make mashed potatoes taste gluey or pasty. With the ricer, this never happens. So it's kind of like a fuzzy pumper barbershop kind of thing where you get these pieces of potato falling into the pot and it's very, very, very dry because you've baked the potatoes rather than boiling them. And they just suck up the cream and the butter or the gorgonzola cheese or whatever it is that you're putting into these very hot potatoes. There's nothing like mashed potatoes made with a ricer. So if you don't have one, I encourage you to give it a try, even though it is a one-use tool. Although I think a ricer would be really good if you were making baby food. It would be a decent replacement for a food mill. I don't know if it would be convenient to do all baby food that way, but it could be used for that. I really enjoy using a mortar and pestle. I have two. I have a wood one and I have a marble one. I like grinding dried herbs, spices. I will also use the larger mortar and pestle for a small amount of breadcrumbs or pulverizing some crackers or something else if I just need a small amount. I love having a cooling rack. It's totally not essential, but I do like using it. And in my small kitchen, I like having an elevated cooling rack because I can put some other things underneath the cooling rack and I don't completely lose my counter space. So that's nice. And finally, another tool that I used for this recipe from Sylvia Joran is a set of mini loaf pans that I purchased about a year ago. They're a really nice coated loaf pan, mini loaf pan. So a typical recipe will fill two of these. It's nice for a small family because we can eat one of the loaves and I wrap the other one really tightly in foil and put it in the freezer. It's great to take out if company's coming or if you just want, a little something dessert-wise, but you haven't had time to make anything. These mini loaf pans have a super wide rim all the way around the pan, which make them really easy to handle in the oven and grip with your oven mitts without worrying about losing or dropping them. Often I find with small things in the oven, they can be really difficult to manipulate. These mini loaf pans, they are the best thing. I really like them. All right, so that's that's that for ever expanding skill set and some of the tools that are not essential by any means, but that I really enjoy using in my kitchen and help me make the most of my ingredients. What are yours? What tools do you recommend? Do you have anything that you would like other folks to give a try? Do you want to be like a kitchen tool evangelist? Are there things you can live without? Are there things you've just gotten fed up with and they're not part of your kitchen anymore? I'd really love to hear about it and have some conversation about tools on the thread in the Ravelry group. And I think in the upcoming week, I would like to challenge myself to try some new recipes with kitchen essentials. One of the things that's essential in my kitchen are my cast iron pans. I use them for a variety of things, but sometimes I'm not very inventive. I just kind of go back to the same tried and true recipes again and again, and I'm reluctant to try something new. I have difficulty with recipes anyway because I like to use what's on hand rather than shop for a new recipe. But this month, I'm going to challenge myself to think about my beloved tools in a new way by trying some new recipes. For Christmas, I received the new cast iron cookbook, and there are some really good recipes in there that I would like to try and tell you about a little bit in upcoming episodes. Double happiness. Last episode, I mentioned that some products from my grant had begun to arrive, and now everything is in. And there are three spinners at one of the high schools who have come back to do some plying and leave with additional Rolex to keep spinning. So this has been so enjoyable. It makes Mondays an occasion to look forward to. And the spinners are doing really well. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they turn up with in the upcoming week and see how we progress from spinning maybe to weaving some of that hand spun, I think might be a next step. Something else that's been helping me think about how to work with these young fiber artists is a podcast, an audio podcast I've started listening to called Teaching Your Brain to Knit. Margaret and Catherine ask really interesting questions like, what has your knitting been teaching you? And they infuse their discussion of their own knitting with investigation of brain research and other topics that help us understand knitting and crafting through a number of different lenses. So it's very smart. It's nicely put together, easy to listen to. I started from the beginning episodes, so I haven't heard any of their more recent episodes yet. I'm kind of working my way through, but I'm really enjoying it and it's giving me a lot of food for thought in working with my fiber artists at the high school level.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is So Wheat. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Crystal Long and Cesar Diaz. If you like today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, and I hope you will join the Yarns at Yanhu group on Ravelry. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Yes, nature's ever get you high till your face is mine. Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a subway nature thing. It's a subway nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.